the path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, everybody, to Peace Paradigm Radio, a collaboration between the Meta Center for Nonviolence and KWMR Community Radio. Today is Friday, the 20th of February, 2015. We have a great show for you today, including your weekly dose of nonviolence in the news with Michael Negler. And then we have our guest in the studio, Luz Wire from Petaluma, who is a filmmaker, teacher, communication and conflict resolution specialist, so much in the teaching area, and much of that is based on nonviolent communication. And we're going to be dedicating the show today to the late nonviolent communication teacher, Marshall Rosenberg. So, Michael, why don't you take us into nonviolence in the news?
Thank you, Stephanie. This is nonviolence in the news. These are events that you will not hear about usually in the mainstream media with analysis that you would never hear about anywhere. Remember, you heard it here first. And I like to start off with a little note about the culture of nonviolence and how it is becoming more prominent before we get into the actual events and meetings and so forth. So I'd like to cite today a long review that was written by Tina Rosenberg of Solutions Journalism. Solutions Journalism is a wonderful idea, and it's a wonderful outfit that you can look at on the web. She wrote a long review of a book that we've mentioned several times, a book called Why Civil Resistance Works by Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan. And she included in that review a study of an organization that I believe we've mentioned. The acronym is CANVAS, Center for Advanced Nonviolent Actions and Strategies. Now, CANVAS actually has taken on the job after succeeding at overthrowing President Milosevic in Belgrade, in Serbia generally, have taken on the job of teaching other movements what they did right, what they did wrong. So in other words, best practices that they gleaned in their work. And I believe they are the first organization in human history to attempt this. There were connections between one movement and another. There were a lot of movement between the Indian independence struggle and our own civil rights movement. But this is an institution dedicated to teaching anyone who needs to know about it what to do right in a nonviolent insurrection. And that review was in the New York Times for Friday the 13th. So it was a lucky day for nonviolence and CANVAS. Last Friday was Global Divestment Day, and this Friday, registration is opening for a large event to take place, mostly in New York, called Peace and Planet Mobilization. And you can tell from that very name already that they are part of the movement that we mentioned last time, and that is a recognition of the connection among our various issues and our various attempts to cope with those issues. So they have explicitly said our issues are related. This event will take place in April, April 24th to 26th, with sequelae, with things that follow, in New York City. And just listen to this list of issues that they're concerned with: abolishing nuclear weapons, climate change and environmental justice, moving the money for economic justice, new era of wars and confrontations, racism and militarism of policing. We are coming out of our silos, they say, and they are now seeking organizational endorsements. They are certainly going to get one from the Meta Center, because this is exactly what our roadmap project was about. And we were absolutely thrilled to see how this idea that we need to figure out what our interconnections are and how we can support one another, how that idea is taking off. And we are, in fact, coming out of our silos and looking at one another with amazement. I don't usually like to talk about problems and dangers that are coming up, but there's one that's been brought to our attention by a friend, which I think I will just mention in passing, and that is that there are foreign policy people who are really concerned that the conflict in the Ukraine could spiral out to a World War III type confrontation, not excluding the possibility that such a confrontation might become nuclear, and that there are parties in United States foreign policy circles who seem to be actively promoting this. And as you know, a lot of the elements that are trying to keep the Ukraine away from the Soviet Union are actually former Nazis. So the situation there is a bit muddied. It's not as clear-cut as we'd like to think. But I would like everyone to just be a little bit aware about this, to be looking beyond what you read in the newspapers and looking for ways to get involved if petition campaigns and others get started. Okay, but now going beyond the U.S. and going beyond negativity, and those two things are not necessarily the same, I'd like to start in our own backyard with a report from our very own correspondent, Kimberlyn David, down in Panama. Because there's been another one of these successful indigenous uprisings against the compact between international corporations and the nation's own government. In this case, the corporation involved was Dutch. They put up $25 million in capital to build a dam. So this will be reminiscent of what you may be aware of in India, the long, long struggle of a group called the Narmada Bachao Andolan to try to stop the dams that were being built along the sacred Narmada River with indifferent success. Although a student of mine was actually in the World Bank and managed to be part of the team that got the World Bank to withdraw its money from those dam projects and did put a spike strip across the road for them for a while. But anyway, this has been after years of community protest, mostly peaceful, in an area called Barro Blanco, a dam, I'm happy to say, was finally suspended. This was publicly announced by Panama's environmental agency a few days ago. The community involved, a community of about 200,000 indigenous of the Ngobe Bugle group, protested the fact that the dam was projected to flood their homes, their schools, their religious and archaeological and cultural sites in their traditional territory and convert the Tabasará River from a running river into a stagnant lake ecosystem. They entrenched themselves in areas where the building of the dam was going forward. They operated despite great fear of the security forces who acted with a lot of violence in the most recent confrontation. And who knows, maybe the fact that they did respond with such violence led to the successful conclusion. Because the group also met with Panama's president, Juan Carlos Varela, who was elected in January of last year, and with the vice president, who has served on an investigative committee that finally determined that the project developer did not adhere to necessary rules, and for the time being, at least, we would hope permanently, the construction, which was almost completed, has been stopped. So you see this very nice combination of protest and appeals, stage one conflict by the escalation curve, and a successful outcome. And this has not been uncommon throughout Latin America and South America. We are frequently reporting to you about events in the South Hebron Hills because of our personal connection there with the village of Atuwani and the organization called Operazione Colomba, or Operation Dove, which maintains a peace presence in that village. A couple of weeks ago, four Palestinian shepherds who were grazing their flocks in the Cheli Valley near the village of Atuwani, when the security chief of the Ma'on settlement arrived and called in the Israeli army to prevent the shepherds from using land that was the object of settlement expansion. Things get kind of rough. The security forces pin one of the shepherds to the ground, immobilizing him. And meanwhile, Palestinians from Atuwani reach the soldiers and, I'm quoting you now from their report, by a nonviolent popular action, they freed the shepherds. Since the beginning of this year, this is the fifth time that Palestinian shepherds have been harassed in this area, which the Israeli administration declared a, quote, closed military area a couple of years ago in September of 2013. I just like to give you a flavor of the ongoing conflicts and how nonviolent intervention, both carried out by the people themselves and by third parties, have been achieving some successes. This is from Open Democracy, and let me take this opportunity to remind you that in those very bleak periods in between Nonviolence in the News and Peace Paradigm Radio, you could be looking at Waging Nonviolence, Popular Resistance, and the ICNC News Report for some events. So this is from Open Democracy through ICNC. People from the district of Ain Salah in Algeria back in February had a protest and gathered in an area called the Place Samoud. Place, of course, is French, and Samoud is Arabic for patience, and it's one of the words for resistance, nonviolent resistance. And they were objecting to an experimental drilling site some 26 kilometers away from the town. They went out, occupied the site, and brought the rig activities to a halt. Men, women, and children formed a human wall around the site, some chaining themselves to electric poles. These are some of the traditional mechanisms of slowing down and stopping that kind of activity. In Macedonia, over 1,000 students a week ago Wednesday occupied the Skopje University, the faculties of philosophy, philology, law, and economics, to be precise, and proclaimed an autonomous students' territory. This is kind of traditional in that region. I remember back in the beginning of the Troubles in the Balkans, a number of students up in the north formed an autonomous government within a pizza parlor and hoped to spread it from there. And as you know, there's an autonomous circular meter of space on the Berkeley campus, thanks to Mario Savio having spoken there. But these students demand the immediate suspension of a new law on higher education, which has introduced mandatory externally supervised exams, sounding suspiciously, and this is my comment, sounding suspiciously like No Child Left Behind and other forms of what I sometimes refer to as fascist education. We have a personal connection with an organization in Zimbabwe called WOZA, which stands for Women of Zimbabwe Arise. Jenny Williams, a very good friend of ours, visited us at the Meta Center, took away an armload of our books and other materials. And the protests are almost ongoing and incessant in Zimbabwe, and many of them are successful. They recently tried to have a protest on Valentine's Day, which they call it Love Day, and it was a 13th annual Love Day protest where they descended on some government buildings and so forth. Sorry to say that this time they were really dispersed by police violence. Fortunately, as we know, those things can sometimes backfire, and this may be an opportunity for WOZA which incidentally has formed a what we might call a brother organization called MOZA, Men of Zimbabwe Arise. In Africa, as elsewhere, men are a little slower on the uptake when it comes to nonviolence. And hopefully Jenny and her friends will be able to make a good step forward from this setback. And I want to just close by talking about an event that's going to happen very soon in Oslo, in Norway. As you are undoubtedly aware, there is a distressing rise of antisemitism throughout Europe, connected to Israel's policy, ultimately. But anyway, many of the citizens of European nations do not want to be defined by this kind of uprising. And so we have a beautiful thing that's going to take place very shortly, where a large number of Norwegian Muslims are going to surround and protect an Oslo synagogue. The rabbi has welcomed this with open arms. And let me read you a little bit of a version of their invitation. Islam is about protecting our brothers and sisters, regardless of which religion they belong to. Islam is about rising above hate and never sinking to the same level as the haters. Could have been a direct quotation from Martin Luther King. Islam is about defending each other. Muslims want to show that we deeply deplore all types of hatred of Jews and that we are there to support them. We will therefore create a human ring around the synagogue on Saturday, the 21st of this month. That's tomorrow if you're listening to this broadcast live. I want to point out that the organizers stated that they would not go through with it if there were not enough people. If there were fewer than 100 people, they felt it would be counterproductive. And as of latest count, 1,500 people have signed up. So this is a good heartwarming note. There's lots more going on in the world, but we have a wonderful show, and I don't want to stand in its way any further. Stephanie.
Thank you so much, Michael, for that segment of nonviolence in the news. So now let's turn to our memories of Marshall Rosenberg, founder of Nonviolent Communication. We have here in the studio with us Lou Zwyer, who's a filmmaker. He's a teacher specifically of communication and conflict resolution that's based on nonviolent communication. And we wanted to really start to bring out some of the lessons that we've learned from the teachings of Marshall Rosenberg and go into a little bit of depth on that. But let's go ahead and start with some stories about how we found the work of Marshall Rosenberg, or maybe if we've met him. So, Lou, I'd like to first of all welcome you to the show.
Thanks, Stephanie.
So can you talk a little bit about your interest?
Sure. So I met Marshall Rosenberg in 1995 when I was invited to an evening talk of his by a good friend of mine named Gary Barron, who was involved with the Center for Nonviolent Communication, the International Center for Nonviolent Communication. And that evening, I saw or listened to one of Marshall's, you know, classic talks, where he, which was a mixture of theory and examples and joke and humor, and it was very fun and compassionate and intelligent man, very inspiring, and that was the beginning of my journey in learning about nonviolent communication and in teaching it and in making videos about it, instructional videos about it.
So it was really about lighting your flame from somebody else. It wasn't, you know, originally it wasn't just about a book or the practice. It was actually about having seen and heard him and what he brought to the understanding of these ideas.
Yeah. Yes. And over the, you know, the last 15 or more years, I videotaped him on a number of occasions and listened to him, went to workshops with him. So I was both learned from him as a student and also had a great opportunity to observe him and really sink into the ideas of nonviolent communication deeply when I was, you know, making videos about it, editing those and figuring out how to communicate about it.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, you said that you also met Marshall Rosenberg. Do you have a story that you'd like to share?
I do, Stephanie. Thought you'd never ask. I met Marshall on several occasions, and one that stands out in my mind now was a critical moment for me because we had just developed what is now housed in the central circle of the Roadmap Project in Meta. On a Meta Center website. So if you go and look at Meta Center, you'll see a tab called Roadmap. There's a beautiful mandala. And if you drill down on the center circle, we have five recommendations that we make that any person can follow that would make them a more effective peacemaker. And when I had first developed this, I thought it was a little bit out there, and I didn't know how the professionals, the guys who really knew what this was about, would respond. And I was at a meeting in Oakland with Mickey and a number of others, our friend Mickey Kashtan. And so I trotted this out with a little bit of trepidation, and Marshall said, "I'm psyched." He said, "This is great." But I'd also, and that was very helpful for me at a formative stage. But I'd also like to tell a story that I later heard from Marshall. I will edit it for radio a little bit. He was in a prison, and he was asked by the warden to go and, quote, do something with a person who was a serial killer. He had killed seven people, one of them being a prison guard. And Marshall was not in a position to say, this is more than I bargained for, because his whole profession was riding on this. So he went into the room, small little room. They locked the door behind him, and he's sitting here with this person who was paying no attention to him, basically, totally ignoring him, looking out the window. And Marshall said to himself, well, I feel a little bit safer since he's not looking at me, but if I've got to do something, or else NVC has no bearing on these really dangerous situations. So he piped up and he said, I understand you've killed seven people. The fellow looked around and said, yeah. And so Marshall said, well, what do I have to do not to be number eight? And the man said, well, don't call me a liar. Don't call me a blankety blank. So Marshall whipped out his notebook and said, no liar, no blankety blank. Okay, great. And then they had a regular conversation and really got somewhere. And what impresses me, apart from the personal courage, which impresses me no end, but what impresses me is the ability to take a person seriously whom most of us would shun and would proscribe, you know, we would write them out of the human community. Mm-hmm. And his ability to do that was really at the heart of the man, I think.
Lou, you look like you'd like to respond to that.
I do. Well, just a couple of comments listening to Michael's story. One is that, you know, what Marshall offered him was respect, which is what others don't. So yes. All human beings have a deep need for respect. And I'm sure part of what was at issue with this person was a lack of respect. And so by offering that, he created some kind of connection or began to create a connection with the person. And, you know, that's one of the principles of NVC, nonviolent communication, is that all human beings have the same basic human needs. So we pursue meeting those needs in different ways, depending on our culture, the culture that we were raised in, and, you know, the things that we believe. And what we're used to having around us. We have different ways of pursuing our needs, but we all have the same basic human needs. And I'd say the greatest gift that Marshall has given to me, and I'd say to the world, through nonviolent communication, is this lens that you can look through if you really believe and remember that all human beings have the same basic needs. And that everything that people say or do is an attempt to meet one of those needs, then you can start to shift how you see someone's behavior, someone who's behaving in a way that you don't like or that you would like it to be different, instead of seeing them as kind of a monster or a bad person or whatever other label you have for them. You can start to see their behavior as an expression of a basic human need, and it makes you see them as not completely different than yourself. The way they're pursuing it would be completely different than you would do. And it doesn't mean that you wouldn't stop them. But you do start to see it differently.
Yep. You know, Lou, I was once on a panel with the psychiatrist, forensic psychiatrist Harold Gilligan, and he had studied serial killers for 25 years and came away with the realization that they all had one thing in common, and that they were all disrespected in their youth. And he quoted them saying, you know, I never got so much respect as when I shoved a gun in that dude's face. And this is what they're all after. And it would be so much easier, so much more nonviolent to find a way for them to find that respect and short circuit the whole criminal trajectory.
So I want to throw out a question here, first of all, to you, Lou. But I'd love to hear what does he mean? What does Marshall Rosenberg mean when he calls his methodology nonviolent communication? What does nonviolent communication mean? And then I'm going to turn to Michael to discuss his vision of the maybe some of the places that NVC, some of the limits of NVC as he's talked about them. So can you talk a little bit about the difference, maybe the difference between nonviolence as, you know, nonviolence on one hand and nonviolent communication, and then, and really what he means by that, and we'll turn to Michael.
I'll try to.
Okay.
So so Marshall Rosenberg understood Gandhi and King, and he called it nonviolent communication in the spirit of the Gandhian tradition, which is that the idea is that your goal is to create connection with the other person and to, he talks about the difference between power over and power with. So power over is coercive or oppressive, and it's where you use whatever power you have to try to get what you want from the other person by saying either explicitly or just implicitly, look, do it the way I want. Do what I want, or I'm going to hurt you in some way. I'm either going to put you down or hurt you emotionally or, you know, physically. I might harm you physically, or I might, undermine you in some way within your family or the workplace or your community or what, you know, the different ways that people have for undermining. And rather than using a power over technique, NVC or nonviolent communication is more about having power with another person by exposing what your own needs are and making a request related to those needs, and at the same time making an attempt to understand the needs in the other person.
Okay.
And holding those together, their needs and your needs together, rather than one over the other.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, let's go into that for a little bit further, though, because I'm wondering still, you know, so we're still at the level of communicating with one another. Communication channels are open. Can you say a little bit more about that? So nonviolent communication comes in at a time, and it really relates to, you know, the larger spectrum of nonviolence, because nonviolence is all about the conversation, about petitioning, about, you know, not thinking of your opponents as your enemies, but as, you know, potential allies and how you bring them on, and, you know, persuasion versus coercion. So can you just say a little bit more about the places that NVC seems to be working very powerfully?
Mm. I don't know that I can say that about that in the social change arena. I have seen it working in my personal life and in my work life, my family life, in community life, interpersonally.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, you know, the principles of nonviolent communication, which is that, you know, you want to have clarity about what your own needs are and be able to say what those are clearly and make clear requests, clear positive requests. So, you know, there's a link between in NVC making a clear request and in Gandhian nonviolence, you know, constructive program, asking for something positive rather than just saying, well, I don't like what you're doing or I want you to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Marshall often talks about if your request is, I want you to stop this, that often leads to violence. If your request is only about stopping something or getting rid of something, as
right.
opposed to making a positive request for something.
Redirection in terms of what's happening to something more positive and more constructive.
Well, if you're only asking to stop something, often you leave the other person left with not knowing quite what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They have a need that they're trying to fulfill, or even if they're trying to fulfill your need, they don't necessarily know what you want. They may do something else that is also not what you want.
That's right.
So if you can make a positive request for what you would like, you're much more likely to get, you know, what you would like.
And say it in a way that feels good too, right?
Yeah, well, that's doable.
and it
is actually a request. In other words, it's not a demand.
Yeah.
A request becomes a demand when you say, when it sounds like, or it actually happens that when someone says no to it, you punish them in some way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's working in the family, it's working in the workplace, it's working when people are still communicating with one another. What if I'm working with somebody or I'm involved in some kind of a movement and there's no longer, you know, we make our request and instead of being heard, instead of feeling heard and seeing actions change because as the expression of being heard, we're told that we're a focus group, that we're not important, that our voices don't matter. And at what point then where does nonviolence take over for nonviolent communication? So, for example, that where our actions then become our conversation more than any words that we use. And I might be making a generalization there to say that nonviolent communication is specifically a formula of words and that we use. So, Lou, do you have anything to say on that before I turn that over to Michael?
Sure. Well, first off, nonviolent communication can be nonverbal also. It's not only verbal. It's, in fact, listening empathically.
Mm-hmm.
Often is just being silent and being present and looking someone in the eyes and, you know, facial expression. I do think – so your question about how does nonviolent communication apply in a social change situation where, let's say, you've made a request and it doesn't – it's not being answered in the way that you would like.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, as in personal communication, when I ask for something and the answer is no – the thing for me to do is to listen, is to really switch into listening and try to understand what need is being met by the person saying no.
Okay. Okay. So then from there, so say that the need that's being met is the need for power a need? Is that one of the needs listed for NVC power?
No, I think power is a strategy.
Okay.
Power is a method for using resources to get what you want. I think so. The basic human needs are, you know, if you were just boiling it down into like maybe four simple ones or five, would be safety. I mean, that's the one that's often. So safety, choice or freedom, play, connection, meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are many, many more than that, but, a lot of the other words you might use would fall into those categories. So safety might be one. Freedom of choice is one you hear, you know, batted around in the political arena a lot. People are saying they want freedom.
Yeah.
And, So in a protest situation, you know, I'm just imagining now because I'm actually learning more about this from you folks at Meta, but I haven't been so much involved in my own life. In a protest situation, you know, the police are – their job is to provide safety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's – now this, and the strategies that they use, people may have a lot of trouble with the strategies they use, and a lot of the strategies they use may actually not lead to safety. It may lead to hurting people.
Mm-hmm.
But their job is to provide safety.
Mm-hmm.
And I would guess that the individual officers that are out there, most of them,
mm-hmm.
are actually trying to provide safety and are challenged to do that. And then the protesters, you know, what are they wanting? They are probably wanting to be heard and they're wanting some kind of respect.
Yeah. So I see that where I was trying to go is to see if there's a point where NVC sort of drops off and it becomes more of, you know, satyagraha. And Michael, I'm going to actually challenge you with a question maybe that you didn't expect from me after listening to Lou here, is how do you see the relation? What do you see as the relationship between, you know, Gandhi and satyagraha in terms of, you know, truth force and love force and soul force, as never humiliating one's opponent, never, you know, you're always in a conversation with them, even when you are, you know, taking on the suffering of a situation, you know, at its height. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the two?
That's extremely interesting. I've been thinking of it, as you were speaking, Lou, as more of a continuum. That, you know, that famous maxima, I think it was of Clausewitz, who said, war is a continuation of politics by other means. Mm-hmm. So similarly, satyagraha is a continuation of the conversation by other means. You know, and we've always been saying that satyagraha is like a conversation, and when it degenerates into a power struggle, everybody loses. So you could look upon satyagraha as a way of creating the conditions for NVC, classic NVC, to operate. But you're awakening your opponent to a sense of your own humanity. Mm-hmm. So that you know, he or she can see that there is something to respond to. And between the really Gandhian satyagrahi and what I'm hearing about nonviolent communication from you, Lou, there is a deep-held belief, correct me if I'm wrong, that on the level of needs, there can be no irresolvable conflict. My need for safety will never be compromised by your need for respect, say, if we work it out together. Right.
Yes, that's true. Marshall says that over and over again.
Uh-huh.
And I think the other thought that comes to my mind listening to you is that, you know, in NVC, so the purpose of listening empathically and expressing yourself with vulnerability, in other words, exposing your needs as opposed to exposing your judgments when you're expressing yourself, talking about what your needs are. The purpose of that is to see the other person as a human because they're exposing their human needs, and to expose yourself as a human being because you're revealing your human needs. And both of those things have the potential to open the heart of both people to each other, to see each other as human beings, and which is the goal of nonviolence, right?
Right.
Gandhian nonviolence. And what, you know, what Marshall says is when you've made a connection, when your hearts are open to each other, the conflict is almost solved. You know,
yeah.
Once that's happened, the more trust is there, and the conflict, you know, it's very easy to solve the conflict at that point.
Okay, I'd like to take it to a different level as well right now, because I'm thinking of, you know, really tough conflicts in the world where they're not seeing each other as human beings, and only the people that they associate with happen to be the human beings.
Right.
And even there, you know, maybe I'm the only human being, right? This is, mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about those tough situations. I'm thinking about the skeptics out there and who are listening.
Yep.
And yet I'm seeing nonviolent communication as a good kit, you know, tool for the toolbox of activists to help, you know, lubricate the movement, you know, against, you know, the movement for justice or the movement for some issue, because the better that people, you know, who are working on that issue together can communicate and get along and say, okay, this is the strategy that we're going to work on. Because how are we going to create a strategy when there's so much infighting, mm-hmm. right? So nonviolent communication then becomes essential for the activist toolbox to help dismantle the structures of power that aren't using power correctly and who aren't yet in conversation. Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, so I think I hear what you're saying is that even within a nonviolent movement, there may be people who have different strategies they want to pursue, and they have conflicts about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the important thing is trust. You know, when there's not a lot of trust, either between people within a movement or actually between the movement and the people that the movement is trying to make change again. Mm-hmm. You know, if they don't see each other as human beings and they don't listen to each other, they're not hearing each other, there's no trust in the relationship. And the question of, you know, how do you create trust is through dialogue, you know, really listening and trying to understand. And, you know, if you're frustrated because someone won't listen to you, really the only tool you have or the tool that I use is to listen to them. So, you know, seek first to understand and then to be understood. So because I found that even people that I'm in very bad conflict with, if they start to feel like, A, I'm interested in what their problem is, and B, I actually come to understand it and they feel understood, then they're much more ready to hear for me to say, if I say to them, well, so can I tell you now how it is for me? They're much more likely to be willing to listen to that.
And I want to now invite you, Michael, to maybe talk a little bit about the relationship between NVC within movement building and, you know, bringing in the référence publique.
There are two levels of this, I think. There are, by now, NVC has been around for so long and it's so well respected by so many people that there's a kind of general acceptance of the basic ideas as you've been describing them. Listening empathically, that is a meme that you can go out and use anywhere on the street. But then the other level would be the formal mechanism by which an NVC trainee, a trainer, will intervene. And I'm wondering, have you had much experience of that, Lou? Is this something that NVC people frequently do, put themselves at the disposal of movement groups? And if and when they do, tell us what that looks like.
So I don't have the closest thing I have to that in my personal experience would be what I'd call a community thing where, you know, I'm in the world, I'm out in the community, and two people are having a conflict. You know, I see two people who are angry with one another, and I go up and say, oh, can I help? Is there something going on here? And someone starts saying what's going on, and I listen to them empathically. And that helps bring the charge down. Once people start to feel heard, the charge of the situation starts to come down.
And then do you, as an NVC person, also get involved in the follow-up negotiations? So here are two people who are quarreling about something. You take a lot of the heat out of the situation so they can become two people. Then does NVC get involved in the adjustment of the situation?
Well, I understand what you're saying. I mean, listening would include listening to people, both people who are involved, not just one person.
Sure.
And actually helping them to hear each other's needs. And then I'd ask one of the, actually what I probably would do is suggest a request. So rather than asking the person, so what would you like from the other person, I would probably, listening to both of them, I would suggest a request that might work for both of them. And if they both like that, then they might say okay.
Okay, let's say that I remember that neighborhood issues were very big in the early days of community boards.
Okay.
And they're saving the city so much money by intervening. So let's say you have an apartment where loud parties are going on.
Yes.
And you have neighbors who need to go to work in the morning.
Yes.
And so they're screaming at one another.
Right.
But suddenly, out of the sky,
yes,
comes a nonviolence trained person,
right,
who does exactly the kind of intervention,
right,
that you're talking about, and you get them to the point where they're now ready to listen to one another. What question might you suggest to, let's say, the neighbors who have to get up and work in the morning?
Yeah, so the suggestion would be around trying to state something that would take into account the needs that you've understood in both people. So for the people that need to get up early, you're probably wanting some, you know, They want to be able to sleep at night so that they can get up in the morning like they need to. And they'd probably also like some consideration, meaning some notice about if something's going to happen. And then the other people who are having the party, I'm guessing they want some fun, you know, and connection with people. And they like, you know, and music is part of that. So the question then would be, so is there a way that you could say to the person who's wanting more rest and more consideration, you know, is there a request that you would like to make from them about how they do their parties or how they let you know about them that would work for you?
I see.
And then the person say, well, yeah, I'd like it not to go past 10 o'clock and I'd like to know a day before. And then you could say, that, well, would that work for you? And then they may say, no, that doesn't work for me at all. Well, what would work for you? And then you kind of work it around and see if there's something that would could hold the needs of both of them.
My guess is that it would also be very effective if the party that needs sleep and consideration would also make a concession. Like, I'm not going to call the police on you because I'm your neighbor.
Yeah.
Something like that. In my experience of nonviolence, if it's all demand, it alienates the other party.
Right. And I wouldn't call it a concession. So I would say it's a so the people who are having the party might have a request that the person not call the police. So if they said they were going to call the police, part of what they might ask for is, you know, could you please not call the police on us?
I see.
And then they could agree to do that if they wanted to.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and you were just hearing Lou Zweier and Michael Nagler have an interesting conversation about formulating requests in the context of using nonviolent communication for all of its wonderful uses. And I'd like to ask Lou a question about listening, that he's talked a lot about listening, and those of us in this studio have attended your workshop on deep listening that you hosted during Petaluma's Nonviolence Week, and you continue to do this work as well, and people who are listening can also reach out to you and help to learn how to do this work as well. But tell us a little bit about the power of listening and what it is and how it connects into nonviolent communication because and nonviolence in general, because I think that, you know, if that's one of our deepest needs is to be heard and it de-escalates so many conflicts so quickly to have listening, really seems to say about the culture that we're living in is that we're forgetting to listen to one another and that needs not being met. But talk more about that.
Sure. So deep listening is a term that I give to a practice of listening that is based on nonviolent communication principles. And it means listening for feelings and needs. So, and these, you know, the nonviolent communication model has four components: observation, feelings, needs, and requests. We've been talking a little bit about requests. So, deep listening really focuses on the feelings and needs that the person is expressing in what they are saying or what they are doing. And the goal of listening, this is really important, the goal of listening is just to receive the other person completely. In other words, understand fully what they are trying to say, what feelings they're expressing, and what needs they're expressing, and to let them know that you've received that. And sometimes that means feeding it back to them verbally so that you can get confirmation. And I think, you know, the thing of listening for needs and feelings is really what's so new. Feelings are understood, I think, a lot by people. You know, a person's expressing anger or sadness or disappointment or whatever. A person may say that explicitly, or you may just sense it from, you know, the energy that they are that they're in. But the idea of listening for needs, which is that, you know, when in Michael's example, when a neighbor comes and knocks on the other neighbor's door and says, you know, what is the matter with you people? Are you, you know, you are terrible. You're so inconsiderate and I'm not used to judging people, so I'm having trouble coming up with a lot of labels. But, you know, they come in and really harangue the person, you know. So a person who is listening for feelings and needs would say, wow, I see how upset you are. I'm guessing you would like more consideration and more
attention.
Yeah, more attention, right? More understanding for what I behaved in a way that had a big impact on you. I'm seeing that. And I'd like to understand more about it.
And how difficult this really is, though, and how much practice it takes at nonviolent communication and nonviolence. These are both practices, because when you're standing there and you have to listen to somebody who's getting ready to say, who might come back at you with a judgment, with a criticism, and you have to train yourself to hear again the needs in that. And when everything in you is telling, you know, gets defensive and wants to dehumanize at that moment, because there's this, you know, unconscious dehumanization that happens when your ego is attacked.
Yes.
So how hard is this?
Yeah, so to make it personal, so when I was working for the California State University system and I was a director of a technology center, you know, I had employees who would come to me sometimes and, you know, they're upset. Something happened. They're either upset with someone else or upset with me. And I say, yes, come in. I want to hear what's going on. And they would start telling me, you know, da, 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 da. And you're right. You know, what happens? All these feelings come up inside of me. And so the techniques that I used were breathing, saying, I see how upset you are, you know, just trying to stay focused on listening for those things. And then the other is asking for a timeout, saying, you know, I really want to hear what you're saying, and I'm feeling kind of upset myself right now, and I can't really listen to you, but I want to. Mm-hmm. So could we take a little break and give me a chance to calm down, and then I'd like to really hear about what happened.
Very interesting. And so I'd like to start to wrap up our show. We have just a couple minutes left, and I want to bring in again Michael Nagler. And the question is I would like for both of you together to somewhat articulate the vision of the human being that's both behind the nonviolent communication work and the work that you're doing in nonviolence and New Story. And I think that there's going to be something very beautiful to emerge from that. So I just want to invite you, what is the image of the human being that's behind what you're doing? Let's start with you, Michael, and then we'll give the last word to Lou.
Good. My image of the human being is very much of a spiritual being encased in a mind and a body, and that on the level of spirit, we are absolutely one. On the level of mind, we are interconnected. On the level of body, we're separate. And that's the rest of it, I think, would be pretty much along the lines that you were saying, Lou, about having needs and seeking them in common and so forth. What would you say?
You know, I would say my vision of the human being is a person who, you know, loves to play, loves connection, loves to make a contribution to the world and have meaning in what they're doing. And loves to feel connected to something larger than themselves. I think that's what everyone yearns for. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're very clumsy in trying to get those things for ourselves.
That was Lou Zweier from Petaluma, teacher, filmmaker, and conflict resolution, nonviolent communication-inspired work. So thank you, everybody, for listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And until then, take care of one another.
Weetips the rocky highland of Sleuthwood in the lake, the lies a leafy island.